Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. I hope you enjoy this conversation from our 2020 podcast series.
Hi everyone. I would like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of the land on which I sit, also the land on which these events ordinarily take place, and pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. My name is Elaine Pearson, and I'm the Australia Director of Human Rights Watch, based here in Sydney. I'm joined by our guest today, Sophie McNeil, who is the author of this wonderful new book, We Can't Say We Didn't Know, Dispatches from an Age of Impunity. Sophie has a very long and distinguished career as a journalist. She was most recently an investigative reporter with ABC's Four Corners, where she reported on issues including the Hong Kong protest movement, the mass arbitrary detention of Muslims in China's Xinjiang region, and the impact of deforestation in Brazil. Sophie was before that a foreign correspondent, both for the ABC and SBS in the Middle East, and she's won several Walkleys and other awards for her reporting. Most recently, she has left that distinguished career in journalism and has become Human Rights Watch's first ever Australia researcher. Sophie joins us from Perth. Sophie, welcome to the Sydney Writers Festival podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Elaine. And I'd just like to acknowledge that I'm speaking on the lands of the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation and pay my respects to Noongar elders past and present.
Great to have you with us. Sophie, maybe to get started, can you tell us a little bit about how you got your start in investigative journalism? What got you interested?
Growing up in Perth, sometimes it's hard to imagine that the rest of the world even exists, you know, that it's real, that it's out there. And I know you might have felt the same, Elaine, growing up in
Perth too. I'm from Perth too.
So, you know, I had very kind of white middle-class upbringing in Perth. My dad was a footy coach. I've got a lot of sisters, and I was always attracted to things, I guess, that were different or that were, you know, I used to watch the news every night with my parents and, you know, first kind of the Channel 7 news and then the SBS news. And I just became more and more interested in what was kind of out there, fascinated by it. And the real pivotal moment for me, I think, was when I was about 15, I read John Pilger's book, Hidden Agendas. And he writes a lot about horrific things happening in our region, but in particular East Timor. And I was just blown away that no one had ever told me about that before. You know, I hadn't learned it at school. I thought that, you know, I was quite an inquisitive person, that I read a lot. I was just kind of astounded at all the horrifying facts and figures that I discovered in that book by Pilger about the occupation and how complicit Australia was in what was happening in Timor. And so I just kind of, really overnight, just kind of embraced the East Timor cause, and I joined the local East Timor Independent Support Group, and the vote was held in 1999 when I was in year 10 at school, and we had several hundred East Timorese refugees who were airlifted out of the UN compound there by Australian forces and taken to Australia. And some came to Perth, not far from where my dad lived. And so I used to go and volunteer with these refugees. And I guess for me, I just, it started off with that interest of Timor, and in particular with that book, I guess I wanted to kind of do what he did. You know, I wanted to expose abuses and injustices around the world and help make people care and help change things for the better. So that was the original inspiration, and I just kind of picked up a video camera and ran around the world for quite a few years after that.
I love that. I don't know what it is about John Pilger, but I was a little surprised too when I read that in the book, because, yeah, I also read John Pilger. Maybe it's something in the 90s, teenagers growing up in Perth, reading John Pilger's books. But, yeah, Secret Country for me also really influenced me. And I think it opened my eyes to injustices around the world.
And I'd like to point out, though, actually, you know, I'm quite disappointed with some of his recent writing, and I talk in the book about that in relation to Syria. So, there's a different relationship I have now with his writing to the writing that originally inspired me as a teenager.
Yes, no, I totally agree with you there. I mean, you you talk about East Timor, and I mean, I read in the book that, yeah, you made your way there, I think, at the age of 16. Can you tell us a bit about what that experience was like as a 16-year-old? Well,
yeah, I'm one of four daughters, and you know, you have to do something as a middle child to get attention. And so I just, these contacts I'd made with these refugees when they were here staying in Fremantle, I stayed in touch with these families, and they would send me these messages from Dili, and we'd have this free Telstra phone time where we'd call back and forth for free after they got sent back. You know, and they were returned by the Australian government at the height of the wet season to Dili. It had been burnt to the ground as the Indonesian militia and army retreated, and there was, you know, TB was rife and dengue fever and malaria, and people's, you know, homes had been burnt to the ground, infrastructure destroyed. So, you know, there was just so much disease. And so I was like, oh, I'm not hearing enough about that. You know, I'm hearing this from my friends on the phone every night, these refugees I'd formed really close relationships with, but I wasn't reading about it in the media. And so I was like, I'm going to go make myself a documentary like Pilcher. And so I borrowed my high school's video camera and sold chocolate Freddo frogs to fundraise for my airfare. And the Burugoon Rotary Club gave me $1,000, which got me over the line. You know, and the Film and TV Institute in Fremantle let me a microphone. And so I went up there, and I actually got sick really quickly because of all this terrible disease that I'd wanted to make a film about. And I got dengue fever myself. But through that process, I met this amazing American doctor called Dr. Dan Murphy, who was treating about 600 patients a day at that stage. And so I just made a little film about him. I always wanted to be a newspaper journalist when I grew up. I loved writing, but I just kind of fell into TV and did my own camera work back then, and then continued that for quite a few years, starting at SBS, working for Insight and Dateline. And then even when I was in the Middle East for the ABC, I was a video journalist. So I've always done a lot of my own camera work. So I much prefer that than being in front of the camera.
Well, you've certainly made your foray over into print with this book that you've just published.
It's true. It's quite a, yeah. For a TV, I always joked and said, you know, TV journalists famously can't write. So, you know, please excuse the spelling mistakes or anything that got through. There's a few that kill me.
No, I didn't. I wasn't picking up the spelling mistakes. Oh, but yeah, I mean, I love the book. I love how it really is a book about human rights stories. I mean, it is the stories of pretty incredible activists and doctors, and I guess the people that you have met, you know, through
your
work.
It's not a memoir, you know, it's a tribute. That's how I like to describe it. It's a tribute to these incredibly brave people that I was just so fortunate enough to meet. It's not kind of, you know, the behind the scenes of what it's like to be a foreign correspondent. I'm not interested in that. You know, these heroes are the stars of this book.
Yeah, I mean, the book, I have to say, you know, I think some of the chapters on Syria can be quite tough to read because, you know, it is a book also about suffering. But I also found the book also to be incredibly uplifting, and there's lots of stories of courage, there's stories of love. I mean, maybe tell us a little bit about, some of, I guess, those stories that really inspired you to write this book.
I mean, yeah, I guess the point was trying to really show that, you know, human side that you don't get in the news. You know, you get so frustrated when you just have to give that daily news story. So I really wanted to capture the essence of the people, you know, the amazing, brave individuals. And, one of the first chapters is about Basil Anura, amazing Syrian activist. I mean, Nura is a lawyer. Basil is described as the Steve Jobs of Syria. You know, he was an amazing coder and programmer who really helped open up the internet in Syria, which, you know, for a country that, you know, a closed dictatorship like that controlled the flow of information, it was such an important role that Basil had and was working on. And so when the Syrian uprising and revolution broke out in 2011, Basil was in this perfect position to use his skills to try and help contribute to the pro-democracy movement. And Nura, her dad had been an activist, a famous opposition member to the Assad regime, which meant her dad was in and out of jail. You know, for most of her childhood, she remembered visiting her dad in jail, and she talked about how she when she saw him, he always had bars on his faces because that's how she remembered him in her childhood, was just behind these iron bars in prison. And so these two amazing individuals, you know, were swept up in that movement in March 2011 as so many tens of thousands, you know, hundreds of thousands of brave Syrians went to the streets and demanded the end of that 40-year dictatorship. You know, they wanted their freedom. And through that movement, you know, those two fell in love. And, you know, Basile Nuri's story really is the story of what happened to Syria, you know, how it began. And it was so hopeful and it was, you know, it was nonviolent and it was beautiful. And it all ended so badly. And, you know, their love story, the details of what they endured and what they sacrificed, you know, for their country, and how, you know, people just had a choice in Syria. And Khalid, a nurse who's featured in another chapter, he's a similar character in the way that, you know, people could choose to look the other way, you know, support the regime, not join in, you know, just keep their safe jobs or safe lives. You know, or you could stand up, you know, you could choose to be on the right side of history and risk everything for what was right, you know, for what you believed in. And Basile Nuri and Khalid were some of those people. And I never kind of can get over that bravery of these people I met in the Middle East. You know, I think it's something we don't see enough of in our society, this kind of risking all for that greater good, you know, and that sacrifice, that real sacrifice that Syrians made. To try and improve their country and the lives of their fellow countrymen and women. And so I really wanted to document that bravery, because that's the thing. I think the book is inspiring, and I want us to read it and to want, you know, learn from these people and think, how can we be braver in our everyday lives? How can we be more courageous? Because I think that's exactly what the world needs now. You know, we're always looking for leaders, but I think we all need to lead more in our own lives. And I'm hoping that once people read the stories of people like Khalid, an amazing guy who taught himself how to do surgery on YouTube and ended up being the only, you know, self-trained doctor in a town of 40,000 people, you know, Khalid's story is some of the stuff I say, it reads like fiction. You know, you couldn't make it up, but it's, you know, it's all true. A lot of it, unfortunately, it's all true. But yeah, you know, there's another story about Rahaf, a young Saudi woman who I had an interesting encounter with. But again, just incredible bravery. And so I want us, you know, particularly people who live privileged lives, you know, not everyone in Australia, but many of us are quite privileged. I want us to kind of, you know, look at these people and think, what can I do? You know, how can I take upon some of that courage, that bravery, and try and, you know, and make sacrifice to make my world a better place too.
And I think it is that human connection when you break it down to individuals and what the choices were and how they made those decisions to do what they did. Because I think sometimes for a lot of us here in Australia, you know, we're watching the footage of what's happening in Syria, we're seeing the demonstrations, but it's actually very hard to get an insight into what young people are actually going through, and that those young people in Syria are very much like young people here in Australia.
Oh, 100%. I mean, people would always ask me, like, how do you go from, like, you know, these countries where, you know, quite war-torn or things are really, you know, tragic, and then, you know, I met my partner in Margaret River in Australia at a barbecue, you know, and in 2007 it was. And so I spent quite a few years going back and forth between the Middle East and Australia and, you know, Margaret River even. And people are always like, well, how do you adjust, you know, between these different worlds? But what I find, like, amazing is that everyone is actually the same everywhere I went. So I never found it that different, you know, whether I was at a barbecue in Margaret River or I was hanging out with Palestinian friends in Gaza or I was, you know, documenting the lives of Syrian refugees in a tent in a camp in Jordan. I mean, people are the same everywhere, and I didn't find it that jolting because of that. You know, you can pick when you spend time in these places, that's the main thing that comes to you, you know, the similarities, not the differences.
Absolutely. I mean, I guess I want to also drill down into, I guess, the choices that you would have had to make as a foreign correspondent. I mean, you talk about arriving in the Middle East in 2015 to find a region ablaze. there was the civil war in Syria, there was the war against ISIS in Iraq, the bombing in Yemen, the blockade in Gaza, you know, all of these things going on over the following years that you were based there. How are those decisions made, I guess, about which stories and which competing crises you can cover?
Look, it's definitely hard, and you felt like you were being pulled in every direction some days. You know, I remember you'd start off covering the latest news from Aleppo, and then suddenly something, you know, horrible would happen in Yemen, and at the same time you'd be working on your, you know, this story that you're trying to plan in Iraq or something. I mean, it really, that role, that ABC Middle East correspondent role, is really challenging because you cover the whole region. And so many of my colleagues, good friends that I made in Jerusalem, often work for American outlets. So, you know, they only covered Israel-Palestine, or I had friends in Beirut who only covered Syria, and I always had to cover it all, and it was hard. But the other hard bit is how to keep covering a story when people feel like it's more of the same, you know. And I talk about those frustrations in the chapter about Aleppo, where, you know, I think I said something like, you know, if this was the world that we created, you know, that we were just going to stand by and let this happen to Aleppo, then the least we could do is watch, you know, and bear witness to the horror that we were allowing to unfold. And I just felt like, yeah, I'd had these fights with my editors, and I write about it in the book about how, you know, they dropped one of my stories from the 7 p.m. Sydney News, and I was so pissed off, and I tweeted about it and got in trouble because I was told, oh, you know, there was nothing new. But that was the thing. That was the exact point. There was nothing new. People, you know, another, you know, 150 people, whatever it was, had been killed in Aleppo that day. There was nothing new about it, but it was still happening. So in my eyes, of course it needed to be there on the 7 p.m. news. So there is so many frustrations when you're working on those kind of stories. But, you know, look, that we're so lucky we have the ABC. You know, there's many countries where you'll never get those stories up in prime time. You know, I did, half an hour documentary on Yemen that was on at 8 o'clock at night. You know, I really did get quite a lot of coverage of Aleppo on and Yemen in the time that I was the Middle East correspondent. Same with Gaza. So, but you have to push these things. You know, if you just be like, oh, I'd like to do this story today, please, and, you know, send that email to your editors, that's not going to get it up. You have to be like, you know, we need to put this on, and then they'll say no, and then you send another email, and then you'll tweet about it, and you'll be like, and look at this video I've got. It's really good video. That, you know, that's why. So you have to fight for it, and that's, I think, the best correspondents fight for their patch, you know, because they love it. They love the people, and they, you know, are obsessed with the stories. And so, yeah, I think that's what makes a good correspondent.
Absolutely. One of the stories that really, I felt like really touched me when I read the book, you know, you follow the refugee crisis in Europe, and there's particularly one story of, I think it's Nazir, an older Syrian man who you found crying on a beach in Lesbos, an island in Greece, and he was separated from his family. Can you tell us a little bit about, what happened and how you found him?
I mean, Nazir is, I still remember that, like, this moment as clear as day when we were on the beach in Lesbos and we'd seen about 20 boats arrive that day. You know, it was the height of the refugee crisis, September 2016, and it was something nuts, like 20,000 people every few days were landing on the Greek islands from Turkey, because Turkey just, you know, opened up the borders and let, you know, the 3 million Syrian refugees that they had been hosting with not much help for years, and they let them, you know, make their way to Europe. And my brief was to do a story for the 7:30 report. I was supposed to find a Syrian family on the beach and follow them as they made their way to Mytilene, the biggest city on Lesbos. I mean, Lesbos is a little island and Mytilene is just a little city, but it's where the ferries to Athens leave from. So that's how you get to mainland Europe and Germany. That's where everyone wanted to go. You know, Angela Merkel welcomed 800,000 Syrians that summer. It was amazing. And so we're staying on the beach. We're trying to decide, you know, what family should we follow, you know, for this story we're filming. And that's when we saw Nazir sitting there crying. And he, you know, was in his late 60s. He had a walking cane. He limped very badly, and we had my Palestinian producer, Fuad, with us, who's amazing and a key part of a lot of my reporting, and he's mentioned constantly in the book, and Fuad was there and translating for me, and we found out very quickly that Nazia had been separated from his wife and kids the night before on the Turkish coast. They were about to board one of these smugglers' vessels to go to the Greek islands, and the smugglers thought the police were coming and told everyone to run. And it was dark, and, you know, Nazia just lost everyone. And then, you know, after a few hours of being lost, another smuggler said, "Look, I'm sure your family will have gotten on a boat by now. I'll let you get on this boat for free. I'm sure you'll meet them on Lesbos." And he didn't really know what to do. He had no money, nothing. All he had was his family Quran that he was carrying in a plastic bag. So he'd arrived on the beach and, you know, hadn't found them, didn't have their numbers, you know. He's not on Facebook. Like, I couldn't just, you know, get my phone and, you know, send a message. Like, he had no connectivity to the world. And, you know, me and Fuad just looked at each other like, you know, what are we going to do? Like, we didn't feel like we could, now that we'd met Nazir and heard his story, we couldn't just walk away. You know, we couldn't just give him like 20 bucks and be like, you know, good luck with that, you know. So we put Nazir in our car, which actually was illegal at the time. The Greek authorities passed this law to say that it was illegal to aid refugees. But we just felt like, you know, that we had to do it. And all the other refugees that are arriving at that time on that half of the Lesbos, they had to walk to Mytilene. And so that sometimes took people 2 or 3 days, and it was like 35 degrees. And so it was really, it was a really hard journey. And, you know, when we were driving back, and as we spent those few days on Lesbos, you'd see them every day doing this horrific long walk, and you just really wanted to put everyone in the van. And we ended up handing out, you know, water and Band-Aids, because you felt so terrible at these poor Syrian families who just survived the trauma of escaping Syria, you know, and getting to Lesbos alive, but then having to walk hours and hours and days and sleeping by the side of the road to just get to where the ferry went. So we put Nazir in our car, and we did that couple of hour drive back to Mytilene, and we, you know, we went to a couple of the camps that had been set up, and we couldn't find his family anywhere. We found the Red Cross tent, registered him. There was no news in the Red Cross system. His family hadn't reported that he was missing. And so, I mean, to cut a long story short, so, you know, but, you know, we didn't give up. We had to say goodbye to Nazir there on Lesbos, but me and Fuad didn't give up trying to find his family, and we were successful in the end. And that, yeah, that story's in the book. But it was a hard choice, I guess, of, you know, many people say that, okay, you're not, that's not a journalist role, right? That I shouldn't have helped him. But, you know, we did a story. Like, we filmed our attempts to help Nazir. And then we did a story when we found his family as well. So sometimes I think that acting with your heart and following your heart and your guts is actually where you'll make the best journalism, and that being a human and acting out of human instinct first will is what's right. And that, if, you know, if you're just thinking about my next story or, you know, my next headline, yeah, you won't get to the heart of the issues. And I think that also I couldn't live with myself, you know, if I didn't just act as a human first rather than, you know, just a journalist trying to do their latest story.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, people will have to read the book to see the extraordinary sort of second half of the Nazir story. But I mean, what you raised about, I guess, this, there is this debate, right, about activism versus journalism, and, you know, journalists are meant to be impartial and sort of one step back from the story. I mean, there's another story in the book, the story of Rahaf, where, you know, again, you know, you took pretty extraordinary measures to help, you know, save this young woman. I mean, Rahaf was a young woman who was in Bangkok Airport, who had managed to escape from an abusive family in Saudi Arabia. And I still remember, Sophie, when you called around, I think it was a Sunday morning, and I was in a yoga class, and I called you back, and you were like, "Have you seen these stories on Twitter?" And then I think we managed to track down one of my colleagues in Bangkok to help.
Yeah, but, Phil yeah. Robertson.
But yeah, I mean, I guess that debate about helping people, or, you know, I guess being the more sort of objective, impartial outsider, but then you know, perhaps being unable actually to really get the true story about what people are experiencing and going through.
Look, yeah, it's hard because this thing, I didn't go to journalism school. You know, I didn't study journalism at uni. I don't have a uni degree. Like, I'm like one of maybe the last old-fashioned kind of journalism as a trade, you know, like maybe the ones that from uni with the fancy degrees, they're like the architects. I'm like the plumber of journalism, you know, self-taught. I don't know. It's funny. Like, journalism is, you know, it's about people. It's about loving people and caring about people. And those are things you can't really learn in a degree, I feel. And I, you know, me acting like a human or, you know, me following, you know, my heart first and doing what I feel is right. Yeah, like I said, it always got me great journalism in the end, but, you know, that wasn't why I did it. It was, you know, being able to sleep at night. That's the other thing. Like, I think that, you know, if you always prioritize just, you know, the journalism and your deadlines and all of that, you can often end up feeling really guilty. And it's a way of actually, I think, building up a lot of trauma if you don't take those opportunities to help people, because you are exposed to quite a lot of trauma. And if you always, you know, kind of brush it aside and be like, oh, well, you know, I was there to do a job and I focused on that and, you know, I didn't have time, then that actually can build up and it's really dangerous. And I think that if you use those moments that you had, you know, and often it's really little, you know, like it's, you know, $20 to help someone get into a intensive care unit in a place like Yemen. Of course, you know, like, well, I mean, you should do that. That's not going to take away from your reporting. And this is the thing, like, I'm still, you know, I'm obsessed with the facts and the evidence and, you know, showing you where I sourced it from and all of that. So none of that changes just because I, you know, also, you know, helped someone, you know, if that's what you can call it. But yeah, I guess putting yourself into those situations is controversial for some, you know, particular people who have views about journalism. But for me, it's a no-brainer. And I wish actually there was less kind of lectures in universities about, you know, being impartial and all this. And it's like, it's not about impartiality. It's about caring about people and why you do it as well. You know, this is the thing I think sometimes to me, and one of the reasons why I have, you know, just recently left journalism is that sometimes I felt like it was just a game, you know, that it was just a game because not enough people actually cared about the outcome of this stuff. But for me, it was never just a headline or a story. You know, it was people, people's lives, people's fates, you know, whether they were going to live or die, you know. So this whole, you know, it being just a game, yeah, I'm not a fan of.
Yeah. Well, we're certainly very happy to have you join Human Rights Watch, and we're certainly excited about, yeah, what you'll be able to achieve by caring for people and looking after humans. I mean, I guess with Rahaf's case, also the interesting thing about that was it also showed the power of social media, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
The way in which she was able to draw attention to her case was through those tweets that she sent out.
Which is amazing because then I have a whole chapter about Aleppo where we like live tweeted, you know, 6 months of daily war crimes that no one gave a shit about. So, yeah, you know, I've got these really big juxtapositions in the book. And this is my constant like thing that I'm obsessed with, like what works, you know, how do you get people's attention? How do you create change? And Rahaf's story was just like the planets aligned, you know, he was this amazing, brave young woman who risked everything to escape her fate and to change it. You know, she you know, woke up at 3 a.m., stole her passport from her parents who, you know, she says abused her for years, ran to the airport, got on a plane, got to Bangkok. You know, Saudi women are not allowed to travel by themselves. They still in this day, you know, need permission from a male relative. You know, Mona El Tahawi, the Egyptian feminist, calls it gender apartheid. And, you know, I agree. That's what's happening in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, Rahaf took on that Saudi state. You know, she refused to let them bully and intimidate her at the airport when they took her passport and told her she was going to be forcibly returned. And, you know, that is an incredibly dangerous fate. Like, you know, her life was at risk if she was put on that plane and sent back to Saudi Arabia. So when I saw her tweeting and saying this, I couldn't just kind of watch it unfold, or just, you know, kind of retweet that and move on, because of an earlier case actually that I talk about in the book, another brave, amazing Saudi woman called Dina Ali, who didn't have the luck that Rahaf had. You know, Dina Ali did the same thing, was trying to escape to Australia, trying to escape an abusive family, managed to flee, get on a flight. The Saudi embassy intervened in the Philippines at Manila Airport. And Dina Ali was, you know, her uncles arrived after she was held. They taped her arms and her legs together, put tape over her mouth, and literally dragged her onto a flight back to Saudi Arabia. And Dina Ali has not been heard of publicly since. So I had that in my head when I was reading the tweets about Rahaf at Bangkok Airport in January 2019. And it was just a no-brainer for me. It was like, you know, if Rahaf's case doesn't receive enough attention, if no one's, you know, there at the airport filming what's going on, the same thing's going to happen. And that was why I decided to, yeah, jump on that plane. And yeah, I mean, that chapter about Rahaf, I think you get an idea of what it was like, hopefully, to be there. That was the aim as it unfolded. But yeah, I mean, just an incredibly brave young woman.
Oh, she's so brave. And yeah, it was just so.
And she's writing a book, so keep it, everyone, oh, you know, great. Keep an eye out for
well,
that.
Maybe next yeah. year's yeah, next Sydney year. Writers Festival.
Oh, how would that be great to get Rahaf out to, because that was a dream, you know, she wanted to come to Australia and she ended up in Canada and she loves that. But yeah, it was her dream to come to Australia. So one day.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm so pleased for her. Yeah, I mean, I guess this issue of social media and, you know, I think one of the things that I really like also about social media is it does provide that space for people to be heard, unfiltered.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know certainly from our work, you know, on Manus Island, like it has enabled, you know, Behrouz Buchani, Aziz Mohammed, and, you know, many people to actually really expose themselves what is going on, as opposed to doing it through the filter of a journalist or mm-hmm. a human rights organization. And I think that is incredibly powerful. Obviously for Syria, as you said, you know, despite the fact that, you know, war crimes were effectively being live tweeted, we still didn't see, you know, that was enough, you know, like we were overwhelmed by horror every day through these images. So, I mean, can you talk a little bit about how that is and why that is? You know, are we immune now to,
well, I mean,
to
I,
these
I,
images?
I think we're overwhelmed. You know, we have all this horror now at our fingertips. And, you know, Syria was an excellent case to, you know, of that. You know, and this is the thing, like, with journalists, like Syria couldn't have been covered any better, you know, like, and you didn't need these foreign journalists either. I mean, the Syrians on the ground were the ones taking the risk. We couldn't get in there, you know, it was these brave Syrians who stayed behind, you know, for the purpose of showing the world what was happening. And so we were just trying to amplify their work because, you know, we couldn't get into a place like Aleppo or Ghouta, you know, Madaya. So, I mean, this is the thing. I don't blame people here for turning away, you know, for looking away, because it is overwhelming and it is horrifying. And I can understand why people would feel that way. But my argument that I try and make in the book is that, you know, I think the reason we can look away is because we think it doesn't affect us. You know, of course no one supports what's happening in Syria, you know, like it's horrible what's happening in Yemen. And, you know, watch it on the news and you might try and, you know, be on top of a few basic facts so you can, you know, make some good conversation, and you do care. You'll share something on Facebook. You might retweet something. But ultimately, you know, you just think, like, you're not going to sacrifice anything for that. You're not going to, like, actually allocate any time to it because you think, look, it doesn't really affect me, you know, and I have these other priorities in my life or whatever. But I guess the argument I'm making is that it does, because this world that we have allowed to fester in the past decade is dangerous. It's dangerous for us and our lives and our children, actually, when there is no deterrence to committing such horrific war crimes, when there's no system that enforces the international law, when governments, because this is the thing, like I covered a lot of terrible terrorist groups and militia groups in the Middle East, but a lot of what I covered was atrocities committed by state actors, you know, governments bombing their own people or going and bombing the country next door, you know, Saudi Arabia, the richest country in the Middle East, bombing Yemen, its neighbor, the poorest country. So the fact that these governments know that they can get away with it, you know, and that's what I fear, is that our indifference to what I, you know, I say in the book, we proved our indifference to this mass slaughter, and now I'm terrified by the precedents we've created. And by undermining this international system and not upholding this very basic idea, when you think of all the complicated, you know, international criminal court and, you know, UN international law, but it's basically the rules, right? You know, when there's no one there enforcing and upholding these rules, then that's so dangerous for us when we're trying to, you know, face the growing climate emergency, or when, yeah, you know, you look at a growing authoritarian China, something that has the potential to have, these things do affect us in our lives and Australians, you know, and you know, other people in Western countries. I mean, look at the Syria war, how that was allowed to fester, how everyone looked the other way. And then the refugee crisis in Europe, you know, this is the thing. We think that it doesn't affect us, but it does, it will, and we can't afford to look the other way. So That's the argument I'm making in the book, and that also that we think we can't do anything about it. So I think the book is actually full of examples of how much one person can do, you know, how much amazing difference one brave, courageous individual who's willing to lead can make. And, you know, you don't have to be Hullard, who's, you know, ends up being a self-taught surgeon in a town of 40,000. Or you don't have to be Rahaf, you know, who stands up to an authoritarian regime. You can just be yourself in your community, you know, your school, your workplace. There's so much work that needs to be done all around the world. And, you know, here in Australia, particularly the environment, Indigenous rights, asylum seekers, there is so much work to be done. And I think we're always looking for someone else to do it, you know, not think, hang on, what am I doing? What am I actually doing in my life to make this world a better place? So I'd like to see the book as a bit of a call to arms to try and get people to ask themselves that and to think of what difference they can make.
Oh, I think the book does that very well. I think it really does show the power that, you know, an individual can make. I think the book is also, you know, it's also a book about accountability. And, you know, in the face of all of these, yeah, facts and statistics and videos and, you know, basically evidence of human rights abuses and war crimes, we've seen the failures of governments to act. And I guess on that, you know, I am interested in what your views are of the Australian government, particularly in the Middle East, from your time there, and I guess the role that foreign governments can play in, you know, in preventing, I guess, the worst abuses and in also ensuring that there is accountability.
Yeah, look, I mean, this is it, the accountability bit, because no matter what evidence you collect, you know, if there's no one holding them accountable, you know, what's the point? And that was like, I guess, part of the process I went through writing the book was, you know, I just felt like I didn't sleep, I didn't stop for that 3 years in the Middle East. It was just, you know, from once Syria, Yemen, ISIS, you know, Mosul, it was just kind of this onslaught of horror and war crimes, and I needed to sit down and process it all. And it was just really disturbing when, you know, you think you're like, okay, I want to go, you know, I want to be a Middle East correspondent because I care about this stuff so much. And you get that job and you're like, okay, I want to go to Yemen because that's horrific and we're not hearing enough about what's happening in Yemen. Like, it's outrageous. So you manage, you know, after months of trying, you get a visa, you go to Yemen, right? And then, you know, you manage to get into the hospital and you're filming like literally children starving to death. And it's horrific. And, you know, what the Saudi-led coalition has done to that country is just outrageous. And we don't hear enough about it. And, you know, I don't think it's covered enough. You know, the ABC is not giving it enough attention now. Like, it's really, you know, just the most horrific war and what it has done to that country. You know, a country same size approximately as Australia, the population, and where more than, you know, 200,000 children have starved to death there since that war began in 2015. And so, you know, you make that story, you know, document the plight of these starving children, you explain who's starving them, the Saudi-led coalition not letting things in. You put it all there, you put it on primetime ABC, you know, foreign correspondent, 8 p.m. on a Tuesday night. Like, there it is. And, you know, people watch it. You win a Walkley even, right? And then Christopher Pyne, as the defense industries minister, goes to Riyadh to sell the Saudis more weapons, you know? And then you think, like, what impact did any of that even have, you know? And this is what I'm kind of wrestling with now, like, how do you create change? How do we hold people accountable? Because I just felt like I couldn't do any more in gathering the evidence and showing you what was happening, you know? And like I said, it wasn't in Syria. It wasn't me taking that risk. It was these amazing, brave Syrians that I was just trying to amplify what they were doing. But when there's no one holding governments to account, then it's really hard. And I, you know, I would just be so kind of upset when these things weren't even talked about. Like, no one even, you would really stand up like in the Australian Parliament and, you know, talk about what was happening in Syria or in Yemen or these places. It was, you know, and, you know, more people went to a rally in Sydney about the hours that bars were allowed to open than about, you know, war crimes in Syria or Yemen or Gaza. So, yeah, it upset me a lot, and my book is kind of an exercise in trying to understand why that is the case and try to change it. Yeah.
But I think exposing those things is definitely the first step to changing them. I mean, your reporting, you know, you talk about those links and, you know, the Australian defence exports to Saudi Arabia, despite, you know, the horrific abuses that were being caused because of the bombing campaign in Yemen. I mean, that work really led, you know, many organisations, Human Rights Watch included, actually to really pressure the Australian government for more transparency around that. So I think, you know, there actually is that really important synergy, I think, between journalism and activism, which is so important. And I guess, you know, that's why I'm really excited that, you know, I guess you're making that leap from one side to the other. But yeah, I hope you don't feel too despondent that things don't change, because reporting on the civilian casualties, you know, that actually did result in the Australian government becoming much more transparent.
Look, it's a funny one. It's like, for me, you know, I've spent now 17 years doing this, you know, pointing out all the horrors, you know. I feel like, you know, it started with East Timor, and yeah, then I quickly fell in love with the Middle East. And, you know, I was on and off there for like 15 years, and I love the place dearly. But I guess what I'm finding now is that, you know, it's quite easy to just point out all the problems sometimes, right? They're everywhere, and, you know, I have shown you a lot of them, and they're horrible. But what's really hard is finding the solutions and making people care and changing policy, you know, and getting the people with influence, you know, to give a shit. And one thing I think sometimes is that we, as, you know, just members of public who, you know, like, we care, but we think that's not our role. And I remember once, you know, reading about Samantha Power, who was the ambassador to the UN under Barack Obama's administration. And Samantha Power has a really great book about America's role in turning a blind eye to genocide, right? And it's called A Problem from Hell. Really great read. Well, it's not great, actually. It's really depressing. But if you're interested in that stuff like I am, you know, genocide and war crimes, it's a really good, well-written book. And Samantha Power was talking with these Congress people, you know, who, because she was researching the Rwandan genocide, and she was asking them, like, you know, what pressure did you kind of get from your constituents about what was happening, you know? And this thing, no one called their offices. Like, one congressman was like, oh, people used to call about saving the gorillas, you know, but no one ever mentioned the Rwandan genocide. So this is the thing, like, what we can get angry at our politicians for not caring about this stuff, but we don't hold them accountable. You know, how many people, you know, have written letters about Syria and called up their MP and asked to talk about Yemen, and, you know, this company that's based in Canberra who's making those weapons that's being sold to the Saudis, like, you know, how many of the constituents in that particular part of Canberra, you know, called up their MP and said, that's not cool, they shouldn't be getting government grants to, you know, develop these weapon systems. I mean, all this stuff, like, we need to put the pressure on. This is it. We need to act. We need to, you know, self-sacrifice. We need to sacrifice for the greater good. And all of us in our own lives, take a few steps about things we care about and do something, you know, stop reading and tweeting and do something, you know. I think, and it was funny, someone wrote a review of the book, actually, and I didn't even think of this before, but they said, like, oh, you know, the book really is calling on you to step over that line the way that I did several times and do something. And I thought, actually, yeah, that's kind of right. That's the theme that I want everyone to just act, you know. And so this is it. It's the whole thing about accountability, that is our role, you know, to hold our leaders to account. And they're not going to care about this stuff if no one ever raises it with them. So, yeah, I want people to do that.
I think that's really great advice for, yeah, the sort of aspiring activists and journalists and, yeah, people who are really moved by stories that they read or stories that they see. You know, we all actually do have a role to play besides just, you know, retweeting something or sharing something on social media. And, you know, that really can make the difference.
Mm.
Sophie, I mean, you've just joined Human Rights Watch and you're going to have a slightly different focus. You'd be turning sort of inwards in terms of looking at human rights issues here in Australia. You know, a final question, you know, what are you hoping to focus on? I know it's still very new, but yeah, what's next?
Oh, look, I mean, it's just, this is a role that's never been had before, you know, Australia Researcher for Human Rights Watch. And I think it's really timely. You know, there are so many things in this country that need changing, basically. You know, I think what always amazes me is just like how privileged Australia is. You know, when you spend so many years traveling around the world and seeing like the healthcare systems of other countries or the education systems and things like that, and you come back here, and I think that's, I always find it really hard when I think people here don't realize often how lucky we have it. But this is it. It's not all Australians. And there are so many issues that where we fail, but because we're such a lucky, wealthy country, like we have no excuse, you know, to have the rates of Indigenous incarceration that we have, the healthcare outcomes for Indigenous Australians, our treatment of asylum seekers, you know, the absolute failures in so many aged care homes. I almost think that because we're so lucky and wealthy, that it makes our failings, you know, even worse, you know, and hurt even more when you can see such blind spots in our society. So, you know, there, I feel like I've got my work cut out for me, and, it is particularly hard during the times of COVID when, you know, you can't travel around and things like that so much. But, look, I'm really excited, and I think, like I said, I've spent a lot of years pointing out everything that's wrong. And now, you know, part of my job is going to be also trying to work out solutions and trying to, you know, advocate on them. And it is a particular skill and I've got a lot to learn. But I feel this is what's right for me now.
Oh, well, much, much work for you to do. But, yeah, very excited about the next chapter in your career. And, Sophie, thanks so much for joining us today. So that's Sophie McNeil. The book is We Can't Say We Didn't Know, Dispatches from an Age of Impunity. It is available at your independent bookstore. So I would encourage everyone listening to this podcast to get down or order a copy from your local bookseller. And thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. Thank you to the Sydney Writers Festival. And thanks so much to everyone for listening.
Thank you for listening. Sydney Writers Festival thanks the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund for supporting the writers involved in making this podcast. We'd love you to consider making a tax-deductible donation to help safeguard the future of Sydney Writers Festival. Your support will help ensure that next year we're back at the festival, side by side, listening to exceptional storytellers, inspiring readers, and celebrating writers.